I better put this one too so I don't. Okay, good, thanks. Good evening, everyone. My name is Ron. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful member of, Grupo Serenidad, which is basically just me and God. I've been a loner for the last 15 years of my sobriety. And I'd like to thank very much Jeanette and those that she serves for asking me to speak tonight. I'm not really sure what to say. If I knew I was going to be asked to speak, I would have put on a better buckle, that's for sure. I began drinking at a very young age. I remember getting loaded on apple cider at a hockey party. And then getting really ripped at a elementary grade six party on Southern Comfort. Never been able to drink since then. But not the Southern Comfort, anyway. And one thing that was weird about alcohol is it made me, no matter what was happening in my life, it made me feel bad. It was this magical cure that came in, that kind of just flowed over me like a warm shower, and everything was okay. And I began to pursue that. And I believe for the longest time in AA, when I first came in, I started to, I believed that I didn't have principles. And I believe today that I was mistaken. I always did have principles. Though my love for alcohol became so strong, it became the center of my life. And as it began to spin, and my life began to get out of control, everything was in focus on how I can maintain that center, that my alcohol. I couldn't play hockey anymore because it got into my time and money, and I couldn't do this and I couldn't do that. And slowly I began this pursuit for this relationship with this alcohol. And I drank hard, and I felt proud that I could drink the way I did. And I started to feel a little bit... My dad sobered up when I was 9 months old. And so I grew up going to Al-Anon, Alateens and Roundups, and all this, and, you know, being forced by those Al-Anons, they're reading their flipping meeting, and all this stuff. And I don't know. So in a way, I think it was a weird way that my dad was able to pass on that message. Suddenly when I was about 14, I remember coming home really loaded and getting sick, and my mom bursting into my brother's room, my older brother's room, going to ground him because someone had got sick by the bathroom, by the toilet. And my brother woke up and said, "I was studying all night. What are you talking about?" And then he came into my room, and it was like, holy smokes. And I was always different. I was, I loved alcohol. You know, and I loved the people that loved alcohol. And I began to pursue that. And I was a weird chap because, I mean, I remember being 14, 15 years old, and all my older brother's girlfriend's older brother was one of my buddies. And, you know, some of my buddies were 30, 32, and they accepted me as one of their own. I drank with them and partied with them. This pursuit began to slowly, as this vicious cycle of alcoholism got out of control. I remember the last years of my drinking, drinking with me was like trying to make a margarita. I mean, my emotions were in the blender. And people just didn't know how Ron was going to act, not even me. I go into a bar room and have a beer, and one second I'm happy, go lucky, next second I'm breaking a pool cue and breaking things, and then suddenly I'm crying, and just out of control, you know. And as this began, I slowly started to seem to lose a lot of friends. People didn't seem to want to be around me. And really had bad luck with women. really bad luck with women. And I'm not too sure why, but I just really had really bad luck with women. And suddenly in January, right after Black Friday in Alberta, before that I got kicked out of hockey. They thought I was a little bit too violent and did a lot of other stuff and got kicked out of schools. And I went into the welding industry, and that kind of put me back on track. Well, September 1987, right after Black Friday in Alberta, well, that's when the tornado went through. I was on a construction site, and I picked up, didn't have a dime in my pocket. I was in love with this sick woman, and she didn't know. I was in love with her, she just didn't love me. And so I picked up with 25 cents in my pocket and landed here in Toronto at the very peak of my alcoholism. And drank for another 4 months, very miserable, very tough place to drink in Toronto. The way I drank, you didn't seem, not too many people want to sit down and have a drink with me. And I worked up at Kipling and up at Steele's in Islington, and my boss gave me a bottle for my Christmas. At the time, I was on antidepressants, and the doctor seemed to think that I had suffered from depression a little bit. My last drunk, big drunk, you know, one of those medal winner ones, was January 1st, or January 2nd, 1988. And I was taking my antidepressants, and I was drunk and on this big pity party, and decided I'm going to commit suicide. So I cut my arm up from here up and called the suicidal prevention line. It was busy. The operator said it was busy, so went and poured myself another drink, and did a couple more cuts from up here up to here, and called again. And after the fifth time, the operator said, "You still in Toronto?" They said, the operator said, "You still haven't got through yet?" I said, "No. What do they want me to do? Make a decision?" Like, so I woke up the next morning. I had cuts all over my chest and all over my arm. And that was my last big medal winner. And my brother was sitting at the foot of my bed saying, "What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?" I didn't know. I just didn't know. And it was just a real bad tear, that was all. And I went to church, and because my uncle was one of those poor alcoholics who was dying of alcoholism. And I went to go pray for him. And I don't know. After that, leaving there, I thought, you know, I'm going to go to Al-Anon, because I go to Al-Anon up at up at the road up here. Up by the, there's a mall up there. There was a meeting there.
Albion.
And there's this girl came up. She goes after the meeting in Al-Anon and said, "You know, why don't you go? Why don't we go out tomorrow night?" And I thought I was gonna get lucky. I mean, I'm not saying this because I'm proud, but this is just what my story was. And I thought, well, finally I'm gonna meet this girl and we're gonna hook up. And she brings me to a meeting. She brings me to an AA meeting. And I remember, this isn't for me. No way. Seeing the slogans and everything inside me fighting it. No way, this isn't for me. This is not for me. And then at that meeting, a beautiful blonde girl comes up and says, "Keep coming back." And I said, "Whoa, there's another possible prospect." And a really funny thing happened, because as I kept coming back, trying to find these pretty ladies, you know, something really weird happened to me, because my whole life, you know, the doctors would say, you know, the psychologist would say, you know, you have a lot of anger, you've got to hit your pillow at night. And the psychiatric would say, you know, here's Sumantle and Prozac and Imipramine. And the priest would say, you know, go to confession and participate in the Eucharist. And no one just said, "Hey, stupid, quit drinking," you know. And I always felt different. But coming to these meetings, looking for those pretty girls, I identified. And I didn't identify because of concepts or traditions or people beating me up with the big book. I about the sick stuff they were talking about in meetings. and people falling over Christmas trees, being drunk, and say, I did that, you know. And that's just how it worked. And after I identified, I remember I was about two months coming to this meeting, that it just, the light came on. And I'll tell you, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is, I believe, Rexdale United saved my life. And I think it's one of the best examples of A that I've ever seen. Alcoholics Anonymous loved me until I was able to love myself. And I started coming to meetings, and I had these real, you know, crazy sponsors, and, you know, crazy as a loon, and started sweeping floors and washing dishes and going to the Metro West and going to the Humber Hospital, I think it was, and going here, going there, and going to district, going to over here, going over there. I mean, they kept me, boy, I didn't have time to think of a drink. I mean, we just don't have time. We got to go. And actually, I think the first time I did my third step was I was with my sponsor, Bob G, and we're in his little fiberglass Corvette flying up the 401 about 230 kilometers an hour, and I threw my wheel and life over to Carragon. I mean, just crazy, you know. But I identified, you know. And it's funny, and slowly, you know, I remember my first kind of a little bit hazy, it's been a while, but about first 6 months to 9 months, I remember crying all the time, just breaking out crying. Sitting in Bob's van over there in the back, all full of that roof and stuff, and then crying. And when's the pain going to go away? When's the pain going to go away? Man, it was hurting. I was really hurting. And I don't know why. And then I was about a year and a half sober. Decided to, you know, pack it up. I'm going to go back out west. And it just wasn't right. I mean, I don't know if you ever moved in AA, but it's really hard. I mean, AA is just not right anywhere. I mean, the only good AA is where you receive the message, you know. And it is really tough. And because I was a little bit loud-mouthed and a little bit opinionated, a little bit suffering from my alcoholism, a lot of these new groups didn't really appreciate my point of view, you know. I was rather open and saying, oh, this isn't right. You know, you just don't do this thing right. And I really slowly started to bottom out. I must have been about four years sober. The boom died down out west. The oil went bad. And no work. Couldn't find work anywhere. Depressed. Went bankrupt. Completely bankrupt. My life was completely unmanageable. Four years sober. And boy, you feel like a loser. You know, I'm doing everything right. Why is this thing not working for me? I think the big book says waves of the past come falling in after us. And I was doing some big rip curls. I mean, I was hanging 10. But I was hanging on, you know. And one of the things that I kept trying to do, what members of this group, basically, people like John and Jim and Jeanette and the Irish guy, McGrath, anyway, a lot of the people, you know, trying to apply what was taught. And it was not easy, you know. You know, one thing I think that I realize today is in my spiritual awakening is I have not quit drinking, you know. It says, A, that no alcohol, that no human power could relieve me of my alcoholism. I have not done it. God, through his power, keeps me sober one day at a time. It's as simple as that. And all that I have to do is try and seek and do his will in my life, and in turn, he keeps me sober. It's as simple as that. It is not any more difficult than that. My difficult part is I'm not all that well in tune with the will of God. That's my problem. I remember at the World Conference, I came back here, and I carried the flag for Peru. That was an experience. And I'm in the lineup, and we did this thing, and all these people are there, right? And this guy from Poland comes up to me right before I carry the flag. And he goes, I don't know why, but God wants me to give this to you. And because I'm so in tune with God's wisdom, I said, oh, thank you very much. And I was going to throw it in the garbage when I get to my hotel room. But I was being diplomatic, right? So I go over. John gets me hooked up into the information thing over on the... So I spent the whole conference in the information booth. And after the conference, I throw everything back into my suitcase, and I'm off back to Peru. As soon as I land, I'm going to a meeting. I go to the Grupo Recuperación, and there's this guy comes up, and he goes, hi, Ron, excellent. There's a guy that speaks just a little English, speaks no Spanish, very little English. He's some guy from Poland. I said, is that right? I said, you know, I have a package for him. He goes, what, you didn't even meet him? But this guy that was two things behind me had given me a Polish big book. The one that I thought, what the heck? Here I am, I'm just a honky-tonk cowboy from Alberta, living in Peru. What am I going to do with a Polish big book? I mean, you know. And I land in Lima. I go to the Grupo Recuperación, and there's this Polish guy. And I gave him the book. I said, here you go. What I'm trying to say there is, I think so often the God of my understanding asks us to do things, and because I'm so fixed on, no, this is my agenda, this is the agenda, pull out the old palm or the BlackBerry and say, no, 9 o'clock, I'm pretty well booked, you know. That's how I try and live today, right? The only thing is I kind of palm pilot God right out of my life. And So when I went bankrupt, in part of the 11th step, it says to, if you are a member of a faith, go back to that faith. They suggested to go back to that faith and become an active part of it. So in my sick mind, that means God wants me to be a priest. And so I go to Bible school and I'm learning to be this. I'm going to go, extremes, you know. And I go there and I go to I'm at the Bible school for a year, and you know there's no work. You know I just went bankrupt. My life's completely unmanageable. And this guy goes, you know, for discernment, why don't you go down to South America and discern your vocation? I said, perfect. You know, like, I mean, they're gonna feed me. They have room, board. I mean, new, another culture. So I took off. I went down south. Needless to say, I was there about 3 months and fell in love and married the most wonderful woman in the world, and we've been married since, 3 kids. And you know what? If God or if the group would have asked me, write down on this piece of paper the best life that you're going to have after you come into AA, if I would have did that and had to stick to it, I would have sold myself short. Since I've sobered up, I've went on this cowboy welder, you know, takes off, and now I went and learned, became an underwater welding inspector, certified welding inspector, quality manager now, and just through the grace of God, you know, I'm just trying to do what's in front of me, trying to serve. After I got married, now my new mission is my family, so I went back into welding. And when I was a missionary, we began a little group, Grupo Serenidad Moquegua. And I was there every day, so we were able to, and it was, you know what, my hat's off to any old timer that has started a new group. I've tried that, and I suck. I mean, I don't know if you guys can really, if you're anything like I was, to go to the church, open up every day, and sit down in that chair and wait, and no one shows. Day after day after day, after week, after a month. It is tough. Our little group slowly started to grow through the grace of God. And but it was tough because, no, tú eres un gringo. You're a gringo. You don't understand our ways, you know. They said, you know, they can continue to drink, work AA, and life's going to get better. I said, well, I don't know. You must be going to BB because what you're talking about sure in the hell is an AA. After when I started working again, slowly this group wanted to do it their way. And something really strange happened. Slowly the group died. And now there's no one left. I'm not saying they went out and got loaded and everyone's dead. There's only Felo. He's still sober, or he's still alive. And Jose is the other one. But out of the 12 people that were constant at the meeting, everyone's dead. And that's the worst part, you know. Going to people's funerals and saying, you know, I could have helped this person. But, you know, that's a funny thing about alcoholism, isn't it? You know? And I think that's one of the biggest cruncher for me that helped me say, yes, I am an alcoholic. If the doctor would have said, you know what, you have disease X, you take medicine Y, and you're going to get better. Not a single disease that I know of who says, no, you are not, you don't have disease X. And this fight internally in my mind that tries to convince me why this medicine, why doesn't I don't have to take it. And know that I'm different. And the only disease that I can think of like that is alcoholism. As I began to serve, like I said, the things, when I went to Peru, I didn't speak up. I mean, all I could say is, Buenos dias, Señorita Gonzalez. I had this stupid tape. It said, you know, Buenos dias, Señorita Gonzalez. Buenos dias, Señorita Gonzalez. It says, good morning, Miss Gonzalez. And the first lady that I met is this, you know, Juanita or whatever. And it's just, I mean, it was just horrible, you know. Talk about, how do you pass the message? I mean, to pass the message, you sit down, you know, sit down the guy, you buy him a coffee, and you share, you know, share from your heart what happened, what it used to be like, and what is it like now. Even you get there, and they're all speaking some Spanish language. You go there, and you look at a flipping menu, and you order something to eat, and you get this little, you know, I don't know what guinea pig is, but you order this, you order a chicken, you get this flat guinea pig that's fried. It's like, what's this, you know? So what I did was I went out and I bought a whole bunch of literature. And a whole bunch of literature, and I said, just started handing out big books. That I, you know, all I have to do to stay sober is hand out the big book or pass the message. This is the message here. Read this. Go into hospitals. Go into the jails in Peru. And passing the message. And that was frustrating. You go to there and you hand all these things to these sick alcoholics that are going to die. Fernando, yeah, became member of the group and died after. One of the doctors stole his book, and after handing out all these books, you go downtown Moquegua, where I live, and all these experts of alcoholism, finally, you know, recently, you know. The doctor's stealing the flipping big book from these sick people, and suddenly they're experts in alcoholism, and they're charging like, you know, 50 soles or whatever an hour, you know. But all I tried to do was just try and continue to serve where A had asked. I've never did this before. I hope I'm sharing from the heart at least. And as I began to serve, you know, my favorite, you know, I did all kinds of, you know, I remember when I was railroaded by Rexdale to become a GSR, you know, like I was only 6 months sober. I said, they wanted a GSR, no one wanted to do it. And they said, well, you know, you do it. I said, I'm only 6 months. And they said, well, you know, go ahead. No, that's just suggested. You go ahead and do it. And you know what? But it kept me sober, you know. And after that, you know, I was served in Peru. I served a term as a Class B trustee in their general service office. You want to see sick? You got to see what happens at the general at that level. I mean, that is sick. I mean, there's a reason we have Class A trustees. Let me tell you. Anyway, I don't want to wash my dirty laundry, you know, our dirty laundry outside the house, right? But But you know, the purpose is you know, stay sober, you know. And I'd like to say, you know, but for the grace of God, that means a whole different thing to me today. You know, the dictionary says grace is an unmerited gift, and that's exactly what it is. I have done nothing and will be able to do nothing to return the gift of sobriety that AA, through instruments like yourselves, have given. And through that sense of gratitude, I feel that it's my duty to try and serve others. And I believe that, you know, a lot of times we seem to put a lot of census on years. After I received my first year medallion here at this group, that was one of my last medallions that I had ever received. Actually, that was about 14 years sober or whatever. I was talking to John, and I think it was John, and he said, "How long have you been sober?" I didn't remember. I mean, when you have no group, you're a loner, right? What do, right? I mean, you stop. The years don't seem to be important as much. It's the fruits of the program, you know, the happiness, joyous and free. You know, the feeling of being able to love another person. And give so freely of yourself, that was what was so freely given to you. And that's what makes sobriety worthwhile. Not a cake, not a medallion. And I remember coming in here and feeling like the scum of the earth and having people, a lot of the people sitting here, coming up and hugging me and saying, "Keep coming back, this works." And not feeling it, but they said, "Well, if they said, then coming back." And one day at a time, being able to, through the grace of God, stay away from that first drink. And I'd like to say that the journey being tough, you know. And just because I've been sober didn't mean that life didn't stop giving me lemons. All it did was AA taught me how to make lemonade. And one day at a time, like I said, I just try and work my program that way. It says that that we're powerless over alcohol, that no human power could relieve us of our alcoholism. B, that probably no human power could relieve us. You know, that God couldn't would if he were stopped. And that's what I try and do today. I try and seek and do his will for his will in my life, and in turn, he keeps me sober. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't say no. I've never done this before, so I've been... and I was a little bit worried because at times I have diarrhea of the mouth, it just keeps running. So I've been watching that clock quite. I was told to keep it quite short because Jim said he was hungry. So with all gratitude, you know, at the World Conference I came and my buddy John here surprised me with my 15-year medallion. And... which it was a very nice gesture, you know. I'd like to thank him, and I'd like to thank each and every one of you for giving me this gift. And I hope and pray that, you know, one day at a time I'll try and reach out to the, you know, to the still suffering alcoholic. And with that, I'd like to thank you all very much for my sobriety, and wish you another 24 hours.